Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is mastering engineer Colin Leonard. First, I want to talk about a trend that's not actually a good one. It's playlist promotion. And yes, those playlists and all of our favorite streaming networks are now being influenced and even purchased by independent promoters. This is being called Playola by some, which is a play on words of the old payola. And if you don't know what that is, there were multiple scandals, payola scandals, a few years back. Well, a lot of years back. What that meant was DJs were being paid by record labels to play the records. And what would happen was they would favor a record because they're getting paid. And of course, this should be illegal, and eventually it was deemed illegal. The record labels got around it by actually going to independent promoters. So they would pay the promoters, and the promoters would then pay the DJs, which was also illegal and was also cracked down upon. Now, many people say this still happens, and it probably does, and there's always loopholes, and independent promoters seem to find them. But now this practice has actually gone to the online world of streaming now, which is a real shame. So what's happening is there are some independent promotion companies that specialize in influencing playlists. And this can cost anywhere between $2,000 and $10,000 for a six-week campaign. It's not illegal, believe it or not, even though Spotify has now spotted this and they prohibit it. But one of the ways around this is for an independent promoter to go to a tastemaker who has a big following on their playlist and basically hire them as a consultant. And of course, a lot of people who are not really high in the food chain in the music business would see that as a badge of honor. And surprisingly enough, they would take very little, $100, $150, in order to add a track to their playlist. So now, unfortunately, this has become something that we all hope would never happen on the internet. And here it is. As a result, you now have to look at those playlists that you're following and kind of take them with a grain of salt, because they may not reflect the taste of the tastemaker any longer. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyowinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. Now let's talk about the best driving music. What is the best driving music? For me, it's always been Charles Erlin, who had a jazz organ trio that I always liked, and it always just seemed to be perfect for driving. For other people, it could be classic rock. For other people, it could be EDM. It could be just about anything. But it turns out the psychology professor Warren Brodsky of Ben-Gurion University has found that no music is the best driving music. Why? Because every song has the potential to be a major distraction. As a result, what he found was that if there's a song that you remember from your past, for instance, that can cause you to daydream, and that increases the potential for drifting into a different lane, for instance. So a song that you really like can be a really major distraction. And also a song that changes frequently in tempo and intensity can be a major distraction. So I'm sure that none of you are going to stop listening to music in the car, and certainly I'm not either. So what's the solution? Well, Dr. Brodsky says that the best thing you can be listening to is an unfamiliar song with a steady tempo and no lyrics, which, I don't know, that sort of takes the fun out of listening to music while you're driving. Anyway, it's probably the safest out of anything you listen to. My guest today is mastering engineer Colin Leonard from Sing Mastering. Colin uses a proprietary technology that has made some of the top mixers in the world his fans. His clients include platinum mixers Dave Pensado and Phil Tan, and his credits include Justin Bieber, Kimbra, Echo Smith, Leona Lewis, and many more. I spoke with Colin from his studio in Atlanta. Let's start from the beginning. I am always curious about how mastering engineers get started, because it's such a unique and singular profession. What happened?
If I'm rambling too much, just let me know. I tend to maybe ramble a little bit, but it was something that that I didn't plan at all. I started off as a musician, a guitar player, and I went to college for classical guitar, and kind of found out pretty quickly it wasn't really my thing. And then a friend of mine was going to Full Sail. This was back in like 97. And he was like, yeah, you should come. And I was like, all right, I'm in. So I did that. But I was still, music was still my thing, you know, playing music, and playing guitar. And I was in a band, a jazz fusion band, in Florida. One of the guys was from Atlanta, so we all moved here together. And then the keyboard player and myself bought a Pro Tools system, which was like $25,000 at the time, and started recording bands and making rap beats for money, basically. So, you know, it's kind of a path where you're trying to like make a living in the industry, and that's kind of what, you know, I knew I wanted to do music as a profession. And, you know, making a living is kind of, you know, what needs to happen. So I started writing a lot of original music for television. I was writing original music and mixing spots for HGTV and all their networks, and a bunch of other commercials. And then I started mixing a lot of those and mixing some music as well. And then I started mixing in surround sound. And an opportunity just kind of fell in my lap to do some mastering locally. And once I did it, it was like totally my thing. And I had done some of it on my own band stuff. But I didn't really start, you know, mastering, with real equipment until maybe, 2004.
Well, how did you learn? Because many mastering engineers kind of learn at the side of a master.
Yeah.
No pun intended, but you know, they learn from somebody, someone mentors them, and you're in Atlanta and it doesn't sound like you had that opportunity.
I had worked with a guy who used to work out of Atlanta, and basically the way I learned the most actually was by pulling up masters and pulling up mixes and kind of doing it by ear. You know, I would spend every day doing that for a while. So I think that was probably, I think that's the most important thing, because I think even when you learn other people's techniques, you kind of have to figure out what techniques are going to work for you. So I actually don't think any of the techniques that I have learned from other people really get used that much in my personal experience.
How long did it take you until you felt like you were good at it?
So I'm still, it's every day.
No, but you know what I mean? There's a certain point where suddenly you feel a lot more competent than you did and you go, wow, okay, yeah, I feel good about doing this.
I feel like, you know, it's a lot like playing an instrument. So you have like, you know, hills and plateaus. And I always felt the same way playing guitar, where, you know, you reach a plateau where you're like feeling really confident. And then, you know, you reach a section where you really are improving and working on improving. And I feel this, you know, mastering and engineering is the same thing. So I don't know. I mean, there's probably little sections in my career where I felt like I was doing amazing work. And there's always those days where you're like, it's just not, it doesn't seem like it's happening, you know? So it's a constant work in progress, and it's also music and the fashion of music sonically changes, kind of constantly, I think. So you know, that's always a thing where, you know, masters from 1999 don't sound like masters from today. You know, that wouldn't fly with clients, artists, or labels. So it's a constant learning process.
You have a lot of great credits so far, and Dave Pensado, who he doesn't give out compliments, you know, wildly. He was really complimentary to you. He said, you have to use this guy next time you have something. So you're obviously doing something that, you know, is attracting a lot of attention, which isn't easy out of Atlanta. Although, that being said, it's easier these days not to be in LA or New York. You know, once upon a time you had to be there because that's where all the work was. But now you can pretty much be anywhere, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Atlanta music scene is pretty good right now and maybe kind of making a comeback. I think it kind of lulled down after L.A. Reid and LaFace Records left. But I think it's kind of making a comeback. But yeah, I love working with Dave and working on Dave's mixes. I just try not to screw them up.
Is there a certain type of music that you find either easier than others or more difficult than others to work on?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm kind of lucky to get a lot of different genres. But I don't necessarily find certain genres harder than others. I think they're different. But, you know, sometimes where the stuff is going to be played, it makes it a little more difficult. You know, the club aspect of some pop music and some rap music makes it a little bit difficult because there's a very real loudness situation with those DJs. And so those can be a bit challenging, you know, because they really want the stuff, you know, loud and in comparison to other big club records. And doing that and having the bass be prominent and clean is a challenge for sure.
I'm going to ask you this question, and yet in a way I know the answer. It's so difficult to get things louder. I mean, how much louder can you get it? And yet Dave told me that, you know, you bring stuff back to him that's louder than he ever could have imagined. So you must be doing something that no one else is doing.
Yeah. I have some proprietary processes that I use. I don't really use plugins. Almost everything I do is analog. But yeah, it's always a challenge. You know, you're always kind of trying to, at least me, I'm always trying to come up with kind of creative ways around the loudness, and really focusing on trying to keep as much dynamic, apparent dynamic as possible in the masters.
How do the proprietary processes come about? What happened there?
Out of frustration, really. So, like, I would be, you know, mastering some club record that needed to be on 11, and I would get it on the verge of distorting, and then the client would say that they needed it louder, and I would just be like, you know, pulling my hair out. And so, yeah, I just try to think about it as more of a, I try to think about the loudness as more of a creative, like, you know, how can we get around this without distorting this? You know, what are we going to do? So yeah, that's kind of how, you know, it's always a challenge. I think all the good mastering engineers kind of, you know, have the same hurdles, and are probably, you know, I don't talk to many other mastering engineers, but I mean, you know, probably doing you know, trying to come up with creative ideas on their own.
Well, I do talk to other mastering engineers, and it's interesting because in the analog domain, it's a lot harder to get the same level than in the digital domain, it seems.
Yes and no. I think, so for me with digital, limiters, you basically have a glass of water that's full already once it's hitting zero, and then you're pushing the level up and then it's just overflowing. With analog, depending on how things are calibrated and how much headroom your analog equipment has, they kind of don't, you know, you can calibrate it in such a way that the analog signal is much louder and clearer. But getting it back to digital becomes the challenge. That's the bottleneck. So I can take something in the analog domain and just turn it up, and it can be twice as loud as what digital zero is, depending on the calibration, and completely clean and dynamic. But getting it back to digital, that's where everything falls apart. So that's where you really have to work on creative ways to get this back to the digital domain without causing problems.
So it's the A to D converter then?
I mean, it's a combination of a lot of things. But yeah, I mean, whatever you can do to get back to digital without distorting. I mean, for some people, it's a, you know, recording it back into the digital domain, not that loud, and then adding gain afterwards too. So, or maybe it's going back to digital, adding some gain, and then recording. So there's a bunch of different techniques in there that you can try. But for me, that's always, you know, that's the key, to making it happen. I kind of prefer analog gain to digital gain usually, just cause it's a little more pleasing and that's what I like. But you know, I think there are some guys doing digital that sound pretty good. I prefer analog.
What's your signal path like? I know some of it's proprietary, you can't talk about it, but generally speaking.
It's kind of a classic setup. So I have a playback computer that all it does is play back the files. I don't really do any processing in it.
What platform is that?
That is a CubeTech platform. Oh. It's a 64-bit platform. Okay. And then I convert to analog right away. And then I have some Dangerous Music mastering console. It's the Dangerous Music Master. Have some little adjustments done in that. But that's, I mean, the stock one is fantastic. And then mostly EQ, not a lot of compression. I only have a couple of analog compressors. I don't really compress that much, so it's mostly EQ. I have like 6 different EQs, analog EQs.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and you know, each of them are kind of good at different things. So I have some kind of like newer really high voltage EQs. And then I have some old Neumann cutting lathe EQs that sound really good in the mid-range that I use. I've got some Manly stuff with transformers. I have an SPL PQ. It's a big analog EQ that I really like. So yeah, it's almost all EQ.
And then when you're going back into the digital domain, are you going back into the CubeTech again?
Yeah, a different one.
Oh, a different one. Okay. I find it really interesting that you don't use compression that much. And I'll tell you a trend I've been seeing. It used to be that back, and we'll say 80s, 90s for the most part, what I would see from most mastering engineers would be that they would have either EQ, compressor, and a limiter, or some variation of that with the limiter at the end. And then I started to see guys drop off the limiter and just use multiple compressors instead. And I still see that actually a lot. They'll use three different compressors and basically get the same thing. And now you're doing something different. If you're not using, you know, compression much, and you, in fact, you're relying more on EQ, that's something yet that's different. It's another trend.
Yeah. I don't really get, especially analog compression. I think that, I don't get a lot of that. You know, I don't understand it for mastering very much. I mean, sometimes it can be nice in some kind of softer acoustic pieces, or maybe rock stuff. Stuff with really transient drums, though, I think it kind of causes more damage than it helps the song, especially vibe-wise. So I'm really more about like transient energy, you know, the fast, high-frequency transients. I really concentrate on not screwing that up. I think a lot of the energy from the song is there. And I don't think, I think analog compressors are, I mean, I have a couple, and a lot of times I'll have one in line, but not doing anything. So it'll be more for, you know, the tubes that are in it and how that sounds, more than, you know, it's more like using a compressor as an EQ rather than using it to actually compress.
But isn't the stuff that you get pretty well crushed already?
Yeah, totally. I mean, why would we crush it more? You know, at that point, you're just losing more dynamic range, and that's not what we need. So, yeah, a lot of times it's already done.
Well, that's another trend, I think, is, I'm not sure whether it's better or worse. It's just a different trend. It used to be that, first of all, there'd be no compression at all in the mix bus. You know, if you go way, way back. And it was completely in the domain of the mastering engineer. And then everybody wanted to hear what it was going to sound like in the radio, so you put a compressor on the mix bus. And then you took it off when you made the masters, sent it to the mastering engineer. And then people wanted to hear, wanted you to keep it on the master bus, so you kept the compressor on. And then it's just started to expand after that. It's like, okay, let's make it as loud as possible and as close to the finished product as possible. So now you look at some, you know, mix buses, and there's three compressors and a limiter and two EQs on it. You know, it's just a huge signal chain. So there's so much that's gone on before you even get your hands on it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the part that makes it difficult too is that I get mixes kind of all over the map. So sometimes some engineers send me stuff and it's really open, and other engineers send me stuff that's really compressed. So learning, like I have to like learn different mix engineers' styles. And after a while, I know what I'm getting from them, which is cool. But it's always kind of a learning process for what I'm getting from each mix engineer. Even within like pop music, there might be one really great mixer that sends me really compressed stuff, and another really great mixer that sends me really dynamic stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of it is getting approvals on mixes. I mean, I don't really want to speak for mixing engineers, but I think a lot of it is getting approvals and them not necessarily wanting to send stuff in for approvals on big projects and not have it be at least close to commercial releases level wise.
Yeah.
Cause some of the guys that I know that mix quiet and dynamic get a lot more complaints about, you know, why is it so low?
I just had the same conversation with Dave the other day, as a matter of fact, and he was saying that, you know, he lives in the domain of loud. Even though he doesn't want to do it, it sounds better when he doesn't. That's what he needs to get his mixes approved,
right?
Just the way the world is today.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times if you know, even Dave would send in a mix that would be quiet, they might think the energy is not quite there, so we're going to try this other guy, and if the other guy makes it louder, then, you know, at the end of the day, you have to do what the client wants.
You know what's funny though? When you go to AES or you go to some sort of conference and you have a speaker manufacturer, you have, you know, any kind of manufacturer that's playing stuff as demo, the stuff that they always play is the least compressed for the most part.
Right.
It's the most open, and that's the demo material, and that's what everybody puts up as, wow, this sounds really great.
Yeah.
It's completely opposite of, you know, the way the world is, at least the pop world.
Yeah, I tend to do that too, to show off, you know, my playback system. If someone asks, you know, let me listen to something that sounds really amazing, I tend to play stuff that's less compressed.
Yeah.
And quieter.
Yeah.
And I just turn it up louder.
Yeah.
But there's also something going on in playback systems that's making it advantageous to have a louder, brighter final product. And I think that's the single way speaker is really come on as what most people are listening on. So, you know, any of those playback systems that play MP3s at your house that you plug your phone into, that's a single way full frequency speaker. The speakers on your phone are single way full frequency speakers, earbuds. So those, since you don't have a dedicated tweeter, those are very, it's just a darker sounding speaker for the most part. So I think that that's kind of causing music to productions to be a little bit brighter and louder to get as much volume out of those little speakers as possible.
What do you do for vinyls? Do you provide a separate mix?
A separate
master?
Yeah, I used to have a lathe and I would cut the lacquers. I don't right now. It's a fun thing to do, but it's also really, really time consuming. And there seems to be, you know, you'll go through days where you have a lot of problems with production. You know, maybe the lacquers got damaged or the plates got damaged, and then you have to spend a whole another day and a half cutting new lacquers, and it's really time consuming. But yeah, I'll just create 24-bit or 32-bit files that are a little quieter for the vinyl pre-master, and then just lay out each side as a long wave file. So like if there's like four songs on one side, it'll just be all four songs connected as one big wave file.
Right.
And then I can send like PQ information so that the cutter knows where the little visual breaks are on the side.
How do you view spreads these days? And it's weird because it used to be, I remember, and this has changed for me, but you tell me if you see that this as well. It used to be that spreads between the songs were really important, and you'd sit there and you'd time everything out. And that's why I used to like to go to the mastering session and you'd sit there and you'd time everything out so it feels right when it goes from the end of one song to the beginning of the next. But we're in a different world where it's a singles world for the most part. So
yeah,
I guess people don't care about that as much as they used to.
I still do. I mean, I do a lot of albums and EPs, and I spend a lot of time on that. I think that's kind of an art in its own. And clients like to sit here and do it. So, I mean, for me, it's kind of still important for albums. But yeah, obviously, when you just have a bunch of singles on an MP3 iPod or whatever, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But I do it so that for an album, I'll export it in such a way that the iTunes files use my spacing properly. So if you do buy an album on iTunes, you will get the right spacing that I created.
So in other words, you're leaving space at the end of the song for the fade into the next song? Is that what you're doing?
It's just the way, yeah. If there's some space between the CD markers, I'll use a setting where it keeps the space between those markers on the final file export so that it will carry over into the individual files for iTunes.
I see. Interesting. Yeah. Is there a typical problem that you see on your mixes? And the A-list guys, you probably won't have any, but I'm sure you get some from people that aren't A-listers as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over the place, really. I mean, I don't get a lot of like problems that are really consistent, I don't think. You know, I can't name like one thing that, you know, happens all the time. Most of the guys I work with are really good, I feel like. So, you know, I don't have a lot of complaints. I kind of try to view it more from the aspect of the mixing engineers and the artists kind of making a piece of art. And this is kind of what they envisioned and what can I bring to this to make it better, rather than technically being like, there's a little distortion here. You know, if it's something that's really obvious that maybe wasn't supposed to be there, maybe I'll ask in a really kind of cautious way. But normally I try to view it as like, what can I bring to this project? You know, what do I hear this final product being in my head? Mm-hmm. And try to bring that to the final project. But I think it's more important to view it like art rather than get too technical about it. I try not to get too technical about it.
Speaking of technical, what monitors are you using?
I use Duntech Sovereign.
Oh, okay.
And they're powered with cello amplifiers.
Yeah, the magic combination, huh?
Yeah, they're great.
What's your take on high-end cables?
Oh, man.
I knew I'd open up a can of worms somewhere here.
I have a good friend who makes high-end cables, and so I don't want to... cables, I think they make a difference for sure. How much of a difference and what is the return on investment? I guess you kind of need to decide that yourself. I actually see some of the biggest improvement with cables being on power cables. Because especially with certain pieces of equipment, it affects them much more than others, and it also depends on what the power is at your facility. So I was at another facility before where some certain type of filtering cables sounded much better because the power was worse. My power here is transformer balanced, so it's really clean, and I don't get necessarily as much advantage from certain things like that on, you know, certain power cables on the same equipment that I was. So there's so many variables, and I think it's kind of like a trial and error thing. But it's not like you need to get all solid silver cables or your masters aren't going to sound good. You know, I don't think that that's the case. But I think using good quality stuff matters.
You know, I would have thought that was crazy a few years ago, in terms of changing your power cables, until I tried it myself.
Yeah.
And it absolutely worked. And all of a sudden, I had a little more punch and a little more low end. I thought, wow, how is this happening? But right. It does, you know, it does work.
Yeah. I have so the cables that I have on my power amps and some of my gear are made by a company called Veristar. Mm-hmm. And they're made out of foil. They're copper and silver foil that's flattened. So the cable is like 4 inches wide.
Wow.
But what it does is it reduces the skin effect, or increases the skin effect, I guess. So the electrons travel faster, since electrons tend to travel. I'm talking out of my ass because I have no idea really what I'm talking about, but that's what I've been told. But I think what's really happening is kind of the cable is kind of a passive filter. So it's kind of cleaning up the power a little bit on its way to the amplifier. So I think that that's kind of why that works in that case. So, you know, the argument that I always see is, yeah, you've got, you know, 1,000 feet of regular power cable in the wall of Romex, and then it hits the you know, your super fancy power cable for 3 feet and all of a sudden it's better. Well, I think it's more of a filter, you know, filtering out EMI and RFI before it hits the unit.
Yeah, so the power supply doesn't have to work as hard.
Yeah, and I think it definitely depends. I had some other amps that had better filtering, and the cables didn't make as much of a difference. These amps don't have much going on as far as power filtering, and it really does make a much bigger difference. So it totally depends on the gear and your situation. But I see less of a difference with audio signal cables. I think, you know, if you've got good, I've got good stuff and it's really short, so changing it out for me doesn't necessarily make that much of a difference as far as analog stuff. You know, if it goes really, really fancy with silver cables, I don't really, it's not as big of a difference as it is for the power cables to me.
Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that someone either imparted to you or you learned along the way?
Wow, good question. I think for me, one of the most important things is customer service. You know, really, I feel like I'm here to, you know, it's kind of I guess people can see it as being kind of a fancy job, but it's a pretty humble job. You know, I'm mostly, you know, if somebody needs like 3 labels need files in an hour, I have to be on top of that. So I think hard work and customer service are still like the number one things for my business. I mean, obviously the quality of work goes along with that, but you can't just be really good and then be slow in responding and giving people what they need. So I think customer service is really important.
Good advice, as always. That's dynamite. Thank you for being with me, Colin. This has been great. It's been a lot of fun. You can find out a lot more about Colin and Sing Mastering at singmastering.com. That's one word, Sing, S-I-N-G, mastering.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or just go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.